From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! White supremacists wage a bombing campaign against London's communities of color. How are grassroots groups dealing with these attacks? Also, we'll hear from a New York police officer who was fired from the department for exposing racism. And we'll look at racial profiling from coast to coast. All that and more on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Jeremy Scahill with these news headlines. Accused by Serbian authorities of a barbaric attack that killed at least 17 people, NATO today acknowledged that one of its bombs had missed its target and landed in a residential neighborhood in southern Yugoslavia. Local officials said 50 houses were destroyed and 600 others were damaged in today's attacks on the town of Srdelic. Hours later, dazed rescue teams were trying to retrieve body parts from the wreckage as bulldozers cleared huge mounds of concrete rubble. NATO spokesperson Jamie Shea said a precision-guided missile had veered off course from an army barracks, landing 200 to 300 yards away in the residential area. He said one bomb did not hit the designated target. NATO's acknowledgement came as the alliance blasted targets around Belgrade early today after day-long assaults on Tuesday. NATO has repeatedly maintained it is only targeting facilities that support Milosevic's crackdown against ethnic Albanians in Kosovo. The latest attacks occurred as the Pentagon announced a troop call-up and diplomats accelerated efforts to find a peaceful solution to the crisis. Meanwhile, on Capitol Hill, there could be a showdown over the U.S. involvement in the air war on Yugoslavia. The House is expected to pass a Republican-backed measure requiring congressional approval before deploying ground forces to Yugoslavia. The White House opposes the advanced approval measure as an unnecessary restriction, even though it has said it does not plan to dispatch ground troops. The ground option, however, is being reviewed by NATO's military commanders as the United States sends more troops and equipment to the Balkans. Meanwhile, House members are expected to reject proposals calling for the withdrawal of all U.S. troops from the Balkans and for a declaration of war against Yugoslavia. President Clinton pressed for new controls on guns yesterday, and top Republicans proposed a hard look at the nation's violence-tinged culture as the two parties offered different responses to last week's Colorado high school shootings. "People's lives are at stake here," President Clinton said at the White House. He urged the GOP-controlled Congress to raise from 18 to 21 the legal age for handgun possession and to hold negligent parents liable when their children use guns to commit crimes. Meanwhile, authorities in Littleton, Colorado, say an 18-year-old woman who attended the prom with Dylan Klebold 3 days before he and Eric Harris carried out the assault at Columbine High School bought at least two of the guns used in the attack. Authorities also announced that 51 explosives, nearly twice as many as the original tally, had been found in and around the school and in the Harris home. The young woman, Robin Anderson, was interviewed by the police on Monday and released shortly thereafter. Anderson bought the two guns at a local gun show she attended recently with the two gunmen and was being considered a witness, not a suspect. This according to a Jefferson County Sheriff's Department spokesperson. Calling the sanctions against Iraq weapons of mass destruction, hundreds of activists across the country signed a full-page ad appearing in today's New York Times calling on the U.S. government to end the sanctions. The text of the ad says the sanctions are starving to death 6,000 Iraqi infants every month, saying this is not foreign policy, it is state-sanctioned murder. Signatories to the ad include Noam Chomsky, Howard Zinn, Angela Davis, Mumia Abu-Jamal, Kurt Vonnegut, among others. The ad comes as protests continue on more than 100 universities across the U.S. calling for an end to the sanctions. This news from Miami. In a move that critics say will cause an exodus from struggling inner-city schools, Governor Jeb Bush and leaders in the Florida legislature have agreed on a plan to send children in the state's lowest-rated schools to private schools with state-paid tuition. The plan, which is a cornerstone of Bush's campaign for governor, would make Florida the only state to pay for vouchers for students to attend private schools, including religious schools. It is expected to be approved by the House and Senate as early as today. Puerto Rico's governor will use a trip to Washington May 6th to complain to lawmakers about the U.S. military's use of a training ground in Puerto Rico. Press Secretary Pedro Urdaz said Governor Pedro Rosselló will visit U.S. legislators after testifying in a House of Representatives hearing on the Caribbean Islands' December 13th vote on U.S. statehood. Two Marine jets in the training ground on Vieques Island dropped their bombs off target April 19th, killing David Rodriguez, a security guard. The move fueled residents' fears that another accident could happen in nearby towns. This news from Islamabad, Pakistan. Carrying placards denouncing Afghanistan's Taliban rulers, Afghan women marched on UN offices in Pakistan today to demand world attention for their plight. In December in northwest Pakistan, men saying they were Taliban threatened to break the legs of women who went ahead with an anti-Taliban march. The march was canceled. And finally today, the UN's chief war crimes prosecutor said any peace settlement reached over Kosovo should not include immunity for Serb atrocities against ethnic Albanians. Judge Luis Arbor said the UN will work to ensure that amnesty for accused war criminals does not become, quote, currency in settlement talks. She said the tribunal she leads will absolutely seek prosecution of the highest members of the Serb leadership. The United States has consistently opposed the establishment of an international criminal court, saying they fear U.S. officials would be arrested. That's some of the news at this hour.
Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Juan Gonzalez. Amy Goodman is away today on assignment, and I want to thank Jeremy Scahill for the headlines. Once again, NATO is acknowledging that one of its bombs missed its target and landed in a residential neighborhood in southern Serbia. According to Serb authorities, yesterday's attack killed at least 17 people, destroyed 50 houses, and damaged 600 others in the town of Surdulica. While NATO continues to insist that it fires only on the targets that are part of President Slobodan Milosevic's Kosovo war machine, it has so far killed civilians in at least five separate bombings. Just this past Friday, 16 employees of Serbian television and radio were killed in a NATO strike on its headquarters. A few days ago, Amy Goodman had a chance to speak with John Pilger, award-winning journalist, documentary filmmaker, and author of Hidden Agendas. He also produced a documentary on East Timor, Death of a Nation. He spoke with Amy about NATO's involvement in Yugoslavia, and I'm going to bring you some of that interview.
Well, what I was saying there was that the bombing of Yugoslavia has got absolutely nothing to do with humanitarian reasons. That's simply propaganda. No action by the West, British or American governments in my career as a reporter has ever been undertaken for humanitarian reasons, and this is no exception. It's quite clear that the bombing of Yugoslavia has made matters grotesquely worse for the Kosovar people. Before the bombing, according to the United Nations, the balance of violence in the province was roughly even between Serbs and ethnic Albanians. It's a very, very bad situation, and the Kosovars are under extreme pressure from the Milosevic government. But once the bombing began, of course, the excuse was given to him to get rid of large numbers of people who were driven from and bombed out of their province. I believe that this, and I believe all the evidence actually suggests that the bombing of Yugoslavia is about NATO. And Richard Holbrooke, the U.S. envoy, when he said this is about the credibility of NATO, spoke the truth. Why should NATO be so concerned, in humanitarian terms, for the Kosovars when they don't give a damn about people who have almost identical repressive situations, like the Turks, like the Kurds in Turkey and the East Timorese in East Timor? But we're talking about Europe, so let's stay with the Kurds. Turkey is a member of NATO, and its repression of the Turks, of the Kurds, I'm sorry, is well documented. And the position of NATO, it seems to me, is quite clear that its expansion into Eastern Europe has taken in the old periphery of the Soviet Union, Poland and the Czech Republic and Hungary, and its expansion into the Balkans is now taking in what it calls its associate membership program. It's Slovenia and Macedonia, Romania, and for the mistake that Milosevic made was to deny NATO the right to station American and NATO troops in his country. And within a very short period of time, he went from being, as Richard Holbrooke described him, as a man we can do business with, a man who understands the realities of Yugoslavia. That's how Holbrooke described him at the Dayton conference in 1995. He went from being a man they could do business with to a demon almost overnight because he wouldn't have foreign troops on his soil. And I think there are great parallels there with Saddam Hussein. And I think it has absolutely nothing to do with humanitarian concern for refugees.
You talk about the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and its involvement with the destruction of the Balkans, the weakening of it. Can you explain?
I think the the Balkans has a long and complex and history in which imperial powers have involved themselves for hundreds and hundreds of years. But I think in the modern period, we only have to go back just over a decade, following the collapse, or at the time of the collapse, rather, of the Soviet Union in the late 80s, when the IMF and the World Bank really moved in to Yugoslavia. And I think that's when the U.S. assault on Yugoslavia began. The more we look back on Tito's Federation, the more it looks pretty good in retrospect, in that it was a peaceful, for all its faults, it was a peaceful multi-ethnic federation. The IMF and World Bank moved in to break it up. They brought in their dreaded, their deadly medicine of market reforms, and privatization, and debt, and the effects on a reasonably fragile economy and certainly a fragile ethnic arrangement, although it had worked for a number of years, were devastating. In 1 year, 1989, 600,000 people were sacked without severance pay, and something like 1,500 major companies were sent bankrupt in Yugoslavia. The welfare system was dismantled. The public subsidies coming from Belgrade, from the center, to the constituent provinces were ended. So an instability was imposed on the country in the name of market reforms. The same thing happened in Russia. Exactly the same thing happened in Russia in many ways. And with ethnic strife and the whole fabric of the society being terribly damaged. And that's what happened in Yugoslavia. And of course, out of all this came the kind of local Yeltsin, which is Milosevic, who, a former senior Communist Party official, turned, became a banker and a, quote, reformer, the man of the hour, the great opportunist. And he was a favorite in the U.S. State Department for a long time. And indeed, at the Dayton so-called peace conference on Bosnia, Milosevic, you know, a man had played such a sinister role the violence in Bosnia was regarded by the U.S. as a broker, the man they could do business with, and what he got out of it was that they wouldn't do anything about Kosovo. They'd leave it; he could have it. And that was changed last year when there was a peace conference in Rumboya and in Paris, and Milosevic was told that there would have to be an autonomy, which he accepted. In fact, it was hardly an autonomy because it gave the Kosovars much less than they'd had under the Yugoslav, the old Yugoslav Federation. He accepted that, but what he wouldn't accept was the basing of NATO troops in his country. And that was what the U.S. wanted above all. And when he turned that down, the U.S. turned against him and the bombing began. It is about NATO. It's about power politics. It's about the U.S. uninterested in the United Nations and wanting to use NATO to do its job. About all those things, it's absolutely nothing to do about refugees.
What about the fact that while originally Milosevic had accepted autonomy, then he stripped Kosovo of its autonomy?
Well, what do you mean he stripped of its autonomy? You mean after he was given autonomy in Paris?
Well, actually, before that, what led to all of this is going.
Well, yeah, that's going back. Yes, he ended its autonomy, and that's what the conference last year was about. The American draft plan was to restore a kind of autonomy, which he agreed to. I'm not saying that Milosevic and his gang are not guilty in all of this. Of course they are. I'm saying they had powerful friends for a long time. And those powerful friends included the United States. And the idea that the United States, because it's an American bombing, a few others in it, but basically it's an American bombing of Yugoslavia, terror bombing of Serbian cities, the killing and maiming of people who have absolutely nothing to do with Kosovo, is just grotesque. That's a major element in all of this. Post-Cold War, the arms trade has become central to the economies of countries. It always was in the United States, and I suppose it probably always was in Britain. But in Britain, particularly, it's become a major ingredient in the so-called economic fortunes of the country. Thatcher restructured the economy and put the arms trade at the center. So 1 in 10 workers in Britain are now working for the arms trade. It's turning out a massive amount of arms and ammunition and bombs and missiles and tanks and so on and so forth. Of course, a great testing ground for these was in the Gulf in 91, and it's in Serbia now. They're using depleted uranium missiles once again. A new version of it are being tested in Kosovo. It's a form of nuclear warfare.
That was Amy Goodman interviewing John Pilger, an award-winning writer, journalist, and filmmaker, on the situation in Serbia. I'm Juan Gonzalez. Amy's away on an assignment, and we'll be back in 60 seconds.
was a mighty place. Many years gone by, no, England is our troubled place. Please don't ask me why. To quote an old Englishman, whose name is Sir Jack Union, he told me in song, so sing along.
London Bridge is falling down.
Welcome back to Democracy Now! I'm Juan Gonzalez. Amy Goodman is away on assignment. As America deals with the aftermath of the Columbine High School shooting in Denver, Great Britain is grappling with racial violence of its own. This past April 17th, a nail bomb exploded in the crowded market section of Brixton, a multiracial community in South London. 39 people were injured, including a 23-month-old boy who had a 4-inch nail embedded in his skull. The following Saturday, another bomb exploded, this time in a busy section of Brick Lane, a Bangladeshi community in London. 6 people were injured in that blast. A neo-Nazi group called Combat 18 claimed responsibility for both incidents. Now the government is telling Britain's black and Asian communities to be on full alert for new attacks and what the media have called the nation's worst outbreak of racist violence since the 1970s. Community groups suspect that the recent bombings are a backlash against coverage surrounding the Stephen Lawrence case. In 1993, Lawrence, a black man, was stabbed to death by a gang of racist white youths in London. A botched police investigation of that murder and a failure to bring Lawrence's killers to justice resulted in a massive public outcry throughout the UK. This Saturday, several civil rights groups have organized a march in protest of the bombings from Brixton to Downing Street. And we're joined today by 2 guests. One, Assad Raymond, chairman of the Newham Monitoring Project, a group based in East London that deals with police violence and fascist activity. And he joins us by telephone from London. And Martin Lee, author of the book The Beast Reawakens. And he is joining us by telephone from California. Assad Raymond, could you tell us a little bit about what has happened, what had been the reaction in the communities of color of England to these bombings?
Well, since the 2 bombings have taken place, I mean, obviously, the black community throughout the country, not only in London, is very concerned about where the racists will target next. They have said that they will target all the major black areas across London and across the country. So one, we're very, very worried about that, and obviously very grateful that nobody has been seriously injured or killed. I mean, the potential is there, has been there for somebody to be killed. What's happening now in terms of the black community is that we're organising ourselves to ensure that people are vigilant, that we're not, that the racists don't win by terrorising and preventing our own community from being able to live free from attack in their own areas. And so we've initiated a number of activities, including having volunteers all in the main areas, making sure that no suspect bags or packages or people are seen. And we're liaising also, obviously, with the police authorities in ensuring that they are responding adequately and speedily, and ensuring that they are also investigating who is behind the attacks and making sure that the perpetrators are arrested.
Well, in some of the press accounts, there have been indications that some organizations are less than satisfied with the way that the British government has been monitoring far-right groups. Do you share that viewpoint?
Well, for a long period of time, right through from the late 70s and early 80s, a number of black communities and black community organizations, including ourselves, who've been at the forefront of tackling and monitoring the far right and fascist activity, have always been warning and saying that they are organizing in our community, they are instigating racial violence and racist attacks, and they are they're recruiting young people, and they're instigating racial terrorism. And to a large extent, the state has failed to do anything to tackle that, and it has very much been left to the community for a community response. And in the last 20 years, we've been very, very successful. In Brick Lane, for example, which historically used to be one of the areas notorious with the far right. In fact, It was after a sustained campaign by the black community. Only within the last 3 years, we've managed to drive the fascists from selling their newspapers around that area. This has been an area where they've consistently stood candidates, where they've been behind stirring up racial violence, which have led to a number of serious attacks. And what we've always said is that they are a threat out there, and they do need to be monitored. And we've always also warned about the potential for the far right to be linking with fascist organizations, not only in Europe, but across in terms of the USA as well, and to be instigating a new strategy where not only are they so-called advocating the ballot box and the bullet in the sense of racial terrorism, but that they would actually instigate a bombing campaign. And we have always feared that, and our fear has now come true. So what we hope is that now that the police have taken this threat seriously, and obviously they are now being forced to take this threat seriously, that they will now start to inform us of actually what steps they have taken in terms of monitoring the far right, in terms of the intelligence that they've had. Because clearly the intelligence that they've had has been sadly lacking at the moment, in the sense that for the first week or so after Brixton, they were unable to even tell us which one of the far right groups was responsible. From our own intelligence, we felt that it wasn't the British National Party, the main far-right organisation, or Combat 18, because Combat 18, what we would call its more military street wing, had been systematically smashed by the anti-racist and anti-fascist communities, that it would be very much a splinter group from that was going to be responsible. And that, to an extent, has come true, because we now believe that it is a group called the White Wolves, which is responsible, which is linked to Combat 18, but isn't a part of Combat 18.
Well, I'd like to bring Martin Lee into the discussion. Also, welcome to Democracy Now!, Martin. You've written a book, The Beast Reawakens, which examines the rise of neo-fascist organizations throughout the world. What about these groups like Combat 18 and the White Wolves? What can you tell us about them, and do they have any links to fascist organizations in other parts of the world?
I would say it's almost certainly the case that they have the British neo-Nazi groups, and particularly the group that's responsible for these latest terrorist attacks, have links to groups abroad in the United States. The strategy that seems to be employed here in London is very similar to the leaderless resistance strategy that's been promoted by militia groups in the United States and white supremacists in the United States. It's a strategy that entails not taking direct orders necessarily from one central command, but simply responding to events, dates, and situations so that disparate cells composed of maybe three or four individuals will undertake actions on their own, and that as a result, those actions won't be able to be pegged to one central organizing hub. In this way, it's harder for police to infiltrate these groups and to put a stop to these kind of actions. And that strategy is really generated by white supremacists in the United States, in part as in recognition of the fact that the governments that they were opposing have, you know, overwhelming firepower. They can't go up against these governments directly with military activity, so they undertake terrorist actions instead. And I think that the bombings we see in London, it's quite likely reflects that strategy. In addition to that thematic convergence or strategic convergence, there are direct links between these groups. Combat 18, which Saad Raymond, I think, correctly pointed out, has been exposed somewhat and to some extent neutralized already, has had a history of links with white supremacists in the United States. So I think it's almost certain that that's the case, that these groups are interlinked. London has long been a hub for neo-Nazis from other countries to come and take refuge and to be safe-housed when they're fugitives from their own countries. So there has been that tradition for going back a couple of decades now.
And Saad Raymond, could you tell us a little bit about the history of Brixton in terms of race relations within Great Britain?
I mean, I totally want to agree with Martin in the sense that I think what we're seeing is a network of far-right, white supremacist, racist and fascist organizations in terms of both in terms of the U.S., Europe, the UK, and also linked to loyalist terrorist organizations. We've, for a long time, also been highlighting the links between far-right groups going over to the north of Ireland, being trained by loyalist terrorist organizations. So they've had the capability, they've had the ability to plant and initiate such bombing campaigns. And I think this marks, as Martin said, the leadership-less cell technique and right across the UK. And I think we're going to expect a lot more bombing. In relation to both Brixton and Brick Lane, both have been are very symbolic for the black community. Brixton has been one of the key black settlements in terms of London. It's been had a number of uprisings, largely due to racial violence and police racism, and therefore it's all, for the black community, it's become to symbolise the black community's resistance to racism, as has Brick Lane, because that, again, right back to the 1930s when Oswald Mosley's black shirts tried to march through which was then the Jewish area and were prevented by the Jewish community and the Communist Party from marching. They marched down Brick Lane, and in 1978-79, the Bangladeshi community had a battle of Brick Lane where they prevented the National Front from marching through the Brick Lane area. So both of these targets that have been chosen have not been chosen just because they're black areas. They've been chosen because symbolically for the black community, they are areas of resistance, of struggle, and of a commitment by the black community to not tolerate racism and of resistance.
Martin Lee, I'd like to ask you, what is the relationship between these terrorist organizations, if there is any, and the above-ground neo-fascist movement, which in many parts of Europe has substantial followings, but in nowhere has actually been able to reach any real power? Do they grow in times of growth of the fascist electoral movement, or is it in reverse?
I think there's a relationship between them. These above-ground fascist parties, such as the British National Party in England, that they serve as a recruiting ground, a recruiting pool for the more extremist terrorist cells. They interact with each other. I would say that the mass-based neo-fascist movements that have gained considerable momentum in several countries in Europe actually have been influential in terms of the political arena and exercising and influencing power and policy. Just this past week, we saw in Turkey the National Action Party, which is the parent organization of the Grey Wolves, a neo-Nazi terrorist organization that has stalked Turkey for several decades. They had a major breakthrough, scored 19% of the vote, and will now be part of a governing coalition in Turkey. And it's kind of unusual because you have a social democratic party, ostensibly, in coalition with an ultra-nationalist right-wing party. That's somewhat unusual. We don't see that combination, and yet that was what's about to unfold in Turkey. I think that the rise of these mass-based radical right-wing populists, or I would say neo-fascist movements in Europe and countries like France and Italy and Belgium and Austria, Sweden, Norway, and so forth. There's a direct relationship between the rise of these parties and the increase in racist violence. According to the European Parliament, there's a racial attack in the European community once every 3 minutes. That was a few years ago they gave that statistic. That's probably does not reflect the full extent of the violence, because oftentimes hate crimes aren't reported. One of the reasons that hate crimes are perpetrated are to intimidate and silence the targeted communities. So it's never really fully reflected in the official statistics. But there's no question that there's a relationship between the kind of political demagoguery that populist, national populist candidates promote with their anti-immigrant rhetoric and the consequent increase in hate crimes directed toward immigrants and people of community of color in Europe.
Well, Martin, in your book, The Beast Reawakens, you also talk about the ties of these groups within the United States, including to some well-known figures like Patrick Buchanan. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, just one example for with the British National Party, which is the electoral arm of the one of the electoral arms of the fascist scene in England. They have links with the Council of Conservative Citizens in the United States, which has direct ties, or at least did, to Senator Trent Lott. So there, it extends all the way up to the highest offices in our land. We're talking about a continuum, a spectrum, an extremist spectrum, with different shades of gray, as it were, from one end to the other. In terms of Pat Buchanan, when the leaders of the French Front National, the mass-based political party in France that gains 15% of the vote nationally, currently undergoing internal schism, but nonetheless still exerting significant influence in France. When they observed Patrick Buchanan's campaign for the presidential nomination on the Republican side, they considered his platform identical to their own, really, so no divergence on key issues. So thematically, you see a convergence in terms of Buchanan's own political campaigns in the United States. White supremacists are often staffing, you know, county staff positions and leadership positions. It ties in again to the Council of Conservative Citizens and their deep roots in the southern states in the United States. So, yes, there are these kinds of links. It happens on many different levels. In some ways, the kind of terrorist attacks we're seeing in London of late, as horrible as they are also an expression of political impotence on the part of the neo-fascist groups. They don't have the kind of mass-based fascist movement as you see in France and Austria and Belgium in England, fortunately. And I think in part as a result, you see this kind of activities that are, an expression of their own marginal fringe status.
We're talking with Assad Raymond, chairman of the Newman Monitoring Project in East London. And you've just been hearing from Martin Lee, author of the book, The Beast Reawakens. Assad Raymond, in terms of the response within the communities of color in England, I've seen some press reports where some organizations are talking about actually beginning self-defense patrols. Is there much debate or difference of opinion among the various groups as to how to respond to this wave of violence?
Well, I mean, there is quite a bit of discussion about which is the best way to respond. Historically, the frontline black organizations that have been very active in the anti-racist, anti-fascist fight, both on the street, physically, politically, and ideologically against the far right, have always argued about the community's right to defend itself if it is under attack, and we believe that is a fundamental right of ours. And so we see this very much as just the extension of that right, that putting people out on the street in vulnerable areas is just basically the community looking after itself and making sure that its own area is safe. I don't think there is much debate around that. The key debate now is should the state be banning the far-right organisations? Most of the key groupings on the ground all feel that we shouldn't be looking for the state to ban, let's say, the British National Party, for example, and that merely banning far-right organisations merely drives them underground and makes it even more difficult for us to actually monitor their activities. It's far more important for us to be tackling them on an ideological and political level and winning the arguments and winning the debate and ensuring that they cannot recruit young white people who are being alienated by mainstream society, who do feel that they live in areas of social and urban deprivation very close to the black areas, and we need to be making alliances with those communities rather than having those communities turn against black community and it become a battle for crumbs. And I think this has got to be seen in its wider political sense, that the struggle against racism is a struggle also for economic and social rights for everybody. And so there is a difference between those people who say that the way to tackle racism is merely to ban the far right and that the whole, therefore, fascism will be tackled, and those who say, no, it has to be a lot more systematic, a lot more long-term, and a lot more political.
Well, I'd like to thank both of you as we close this segment, and we'll be continuing to monitor the situation in Great Britain. We've been listening to Assad Raymond, chairman of the Newham Monitoring Project, a group based in East London that deals with police violence and fascist activity, and Martin Lee, author of the eye-opening book, The Beast Reawakens, which chronicles the rise of neo-fascist groups throughout the United States. You're listening to Pacifica Radio, Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds.
All over London, we're in a trade tribulation.
You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Juan Gonzalez. Amy Goodman is away today. Well, we go now from racism in Britain to racism right here in the United States. New York City has agreed to pay $2.75 million to a man who said he was beaten on his way to work by at least five police officers because they said he fit the profile of a black suspect they were seeking. Despite the large settlement with the man, 42-year-old Harold Dusenberry, the city has admitted no wrongdoing in the 1996 case. Also this week in New York, a black police officer, Yvette Walton, was recently dismissed from her job for speaking out against civil rights violations in the NYPD's street crimes unit, whose officers fired a barrage of 41 shots against Guinean immigrant Amadou Diallo last February 4th. This past February 19th, Walton testified before the New York City Council wearing a hooded jacket to protect herself from retaliation from her colleagues. The same afternoon that she testified, she was fired by the police department. This comes in the aftermath of New Jersey Governor Christine Whitman's admission that New Jersey state troopers engage in the practice of racial profiling also, stopping a disproportionate number of African-American Latino motorists for no other reason than the color of their skin. Meanwhile, in California, in response to widespread complaints of vehicle stops by police officers, State Senator Kevin Murray has introduced a bill called the California Traffic Stop Statistics Act, SB 78, which would require the police to collect data on race and traffic stops for search and statistical purposes. Last year, then-Governor Pete Wilson vetoed another bill, which was Murray's first attempt to require the same data be collected. We're going to be talking about racial profiling today, and we have with us in the studio Regina Felton, an attorney for Yvette Walton, the officer fired last week. And we also have joining us by phone the officer herself, Yvette Walton, and from Florida, Jop Kamau, who is the executive director of the Police Complaints Center, a former police sergeant from Hawthorne, California, who went undercover to document police abuse with a camera and was stopped by a white police officer who threw him through a plate glass window. I'd like to begin with Jop Kamau. Could you tell us a little bit about your particular experience when you went undercover to see what was happening with racial profiling?
Well, at the time I was working with a couple of organizations, the ACLU and the NAACP in Los Angeles, and they had documented multiple complaints of harassment of minorities who were traveling throughout areas of Los Angeles, and in particular, the Long Beach Police Department had a lengthy history of abuse, civil rights violations, and other things. And we simply went down to test the premise that they were pulling people over illegally. And what we did was we wired a vehicle with hidden cameras in the front and the rear and with audio recording equipment and simply drove down a street in Long Beach in the late evening, early evening. What happened was that we noticed a police car stopped at a light. When we both pulled alongside one another at the light, the officers began looking into our vehicle. We drove straight for another mile or so, and we noticed that they were following us. And then within minutes, they hit the red lights, pulled us over. I exited the car to ask the officer why we had been stopped and told him to go ahead and write a citation if that's what he chose to do. Within minutes, he was in front of me telling me he was going to strike me in the head with his baton and ordered me to put my hands behind my head. When I complied, I was slammed headfirst into a plate glass window, taken over to the hood of the car and beaten while I was on the hood. Then I was taken to the rear of the car and beaten again. And that's when he noticed that an NBC camera crew was standing there behind him with the camera, and the entire event had been captured on film.
And what was the reaction to of law enforcement authorities to the incident?
Well, similar to what you described in your earlier comments with the situation in New York, they reacted in full support of the officers, validated what they had done, said that it was my behavior which provoked the situation, never asked why these officers had pulled us over in the first place. There was clearly no traffic violation. There was no reason for us to be stopped. But it has become so routine across America that these events happen that people don't even ask those questions. So ultimately, the officers went to trial after they falsified the police. In the actual police report, which is even more interesting, they documented their own version of what happened. What they said is that I jumped out of the car, and attacked the officer, tried to take his baton, and then I dove through the plate glass window myself. And they had actually charged me with assault on the officer, and that was before they knew there was videotape. At that point, things kind of switched around, and we went to trial, and the officers were actually prosecuted for falsifying the report and assault battery. We had a nearly all-white jury, which broke along racial lines. The one African-American on the jury voted for a conviction, and the white folks on the jury felt there was nothing wrong with what the officers had done.
Well, I'd like to ask Yvette Walton, you were a police officer who worked in the street crimes unit, one of the few African-Americans in that unit in New York City. And I've reported on many of these racial profiling attacks in the past. And inevitably, what the authorities say, whether it's Christine Todd Whitman in New Jersey, Mayor Giuliani in New York City, or law enforcement authorities around the country, that this is not a policy. That Christine Todd Whitman went as far as to admit that it was happening, but that it was not a policy. What's your view of what the brass and top officials say about this whole issue?
My opinion is that it's, when they say it's not a policy, of course, first of all, that's what they're going to say. That's what they have to say. So this way they can remove themselves from any culpability insofar as what their officers are doing. However, it's not a written policy. I believe that they know what's going on. It's just easier to feign ignorance. So therefore, if minority people have the wherewithal to take it a step further insofar as reporting the incident and just sticking with it insofar as proving that they were violated, that their civil rights were violated, it is then that they choose to most times settle, you know, while not admitting knowledge. But the thing is, I would like to see more minorities come forward. This is not an acceptable way of life. This is not something that you have to deal with because of your color.
I'd like to ask you, during the time that you served in the street crimes unit, what sort of changes did you go through as you saw what you were being required to do? Could you talk about a little bit about those experiences?
The changes came within me insofar as, first of all, I admit I was in denial, although it was in the back of my mind that this is a possibility, that this is what's going on and it's not right. I was in denial. And until I came to grips with myself and my soul, it was a thing where it can't be happening. This is not happening. But Yvette, pay attention to what you're seeing. It must be for real. And so once I came to grips with what, you know, myself, and so far as acknowledging and realizing and admitting this is wrong, I withdrew myself in so far as being actively, so to speak, involved, you know, with this, and I immediately put in a request for a transfer out of the unit.
And the response of the police department to your firing, to the coincidence of your firing the same day you testified before city council, was that it had nothing to do with your testimony, that it was part of a pattern of high absenteeism and other problems that you had had in the department. A decision had been made beforehand. I'd like to ask your attorney, Regina Felton, to comment on that and what action what you feel about the police commissioner's response and also what actions you're planning to take.
Okay. I mean, it's interesting that you characterize this as a coincidence. That's something that you got from Commissioner Safer. She was fired, Officer Walton was fired within 30 minutes after she testified. So that is quite a coincidence. She was fired, I believe, in retaliation for the disclosure that she made, which seemingly indicated that the police department had adopted tactics that negatively impacted on the rights of African Americans and Latino men. This was a violation described on the tactics used of their right to search and seizure, and not to be unlawfully searched, not to be unlawfully stopped and frisked. here, you've probably heard her speak already, Officer Walton, where she indicated that one of the tactics used is that the police officers in the street crime unit would drive up behind male Latinos in a car or male blacks in a car and shine their high beams. Once they reacted to the high beam being shown into the car, that was and turned around, that was justification for search and seizure. When she disclosed this, I mean, that she was exercising her right to free speech. And the law as it stands today indicates that a public employee has a First Amendment right, and that if that right is being exercised in connection with a topic of public interest, public concern, that the public employee has the right to make that disclosure. It's not for personal reason. She was testifying before the city council, who had an interest in exploring tactics employed by the New York City Police Department, and hence she was fulfilling a public mandate.
I think we also have on the line Bilal Ali, a member of the Coalition Against Police Abuse and on the National Coordinating Committee of the Black Radical Congress. I'd like to ask Bilal, if you have now throughout the country African-American and Latino police officers saying it's true, this kind of racial profiling is going on, what is the response then of those who have been activists throughout these communities saying talking about these problems for years, that now even within all the police departments you're getting the same reaction and the same comments by the African American and Latino cops?
Well, we welcome the contributions of African American police officers on this issue and that are coming out now and speaking out on that. What we need is more African-American officers coming out there and supporting the community and their demand for a call for community control of the police. Unfortunately, there are not enough African-American police officers coming out saying this because of fear of reprisals, such as what the African-American woman had just mentioned, who was a police officer. The fear of reprisals, the fear of being ostracized, or the fear of being set up by their fellow officers. So I understand the pressure that goes on in there, and also the issue of racism within the police department. But it's going to take more than that. It's going to take organizing in the community around police abuse and understanding the origins of police abuse.
Job Kamau, in terms of reforms that could be brought into play in various states, what are some of the things that you are trying to get accomplished as executive director of the Police Complaint Center?
Well, I think the most critical issue is data and the fact that these officers or these police agencies don't want you to know who they're pulling over and the reasons for the stops. Until we have some national data and statistics on what's actually happening when these officers are pulling people over, who are they pulling over, whose property is being seized, how long are people being detained? We've got civilian review boards that have largely been ineffective in many cities because they don't have subpoena power. They don't have the power to actually discipline officers without the police department sanctioning of that. And the police unions have really run amok. And they've got this 48-hour hide rule in New York where you get 48 hours to hide evidence before they can talk to you. And I'd like to really sympathize with the young woman. I had the exact same experience in terms of retaliation, and it's national. I don't know an African-American officer who has come out who hasn't had their own career then reexamined. You could be a top-notch officer, and suddenly they say your reports are shoddy, or that you came in late to work and that you weren't a good officer anymore. That's all dependent and contingent on are you going along with the program. And once you start to buck the system, you find multiple ways that police agencies can retaliate. What we're actually doing is we have an internet website where we take complaints from citizens across the country. We file the complaints. We keep records. We take a video and place it on CD-ROMs and send it to the Justice Department because, as you'll find, in the case where we're with Rodney King, the Justice Department is not keeping track. They said, we didn't know about this. They had something like 23 complaints in 5 years from across the whole country, because they don't actively seek those complaints. They wait for the police department to come to them and say, we've got this terrible officer, would you prosecute? There's a real
Yeah, well, I'd like to we're having a little problem there, but we'll get it straightened out. But I'd like to raise this issue, though, of the collection of data to get a better handle on this situation. But we have the example already in places like New Jersey, where it's been revealed that officers falsified reports and falsified data. And I've reported in my column in the Daily News numerous instances over the years where police officers deliberately falsify reports that might incriminate them, and very little happens. What can be the response in a situation like that where reports are actually falsified? Yvette Walton, I don't know whether you experienced that yourself or witnessed that yourself while you were in the street crimes unit of the falsification of actual reports.
Well, I would have to say not knowingly being aware if any falsification of reports had taken place that I could honestly say that I've witnessed. And in regards to the retaliation on the police department, our police commissioner thought it was necessary to indicate that I had been out sick for 300 days within 12 years. I think that's a pretty good number, but he neglected to include the fact that several of them were line-of-duty injuries. During the performance of my duties as a police officer, I got injured two times for surgery. I also had a police R&P accident. I also had a child. And during the course of 12 years, our physical health may not be all that we want it to be, so you might get sick with the flu or anything else of that nature.
Okay, I'm going to... Yvette, I'm going to have to cut you off because we're running out of time. But I just would like to thank our guests, Yvette Walton, a New York police officer from the Street Crimes Unit, Regina Felton, her attorney, Bilal Ali from the Coalition Against Police Abuse, and Jiap Kamau, executive director of the Police Complaint Center. That wraps it up for today's show. If you'd like a cassette of the program, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. You can also listen to the show by going on our website, www.pacifica.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Cajon and David Love. Our technical director is Errol Maitland. Special thanks to Michael Ide. I'm Juan Gonzalez. Thank you for listening to another edition of Democracy Now! From the studios of WBAI in New York. And we'll be sure to get that website for you so that you can send in your complaints on police abuse and give it to you tomorrow. Thank you.